Translation. Of all yogis, the one with great faith who abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is most intimately united with me in yoga, and in the highest, and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. Please repeat. And of all yogis, the one with great faith, who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is the most intimately united with me in yoga, and is the highest of all. That is my opinion. So it's quite a long purport, so I'll just read a little bit of it for today's purposes. The word bhajati is significant here. Bhajati has its roots in the verb bhaj, which is used when there is need of service. The English word worship can be used in the same sense as bhaj. Worship means to adore, to show respect, to honor, to the worthy one. But service with love and faith is especially meant for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One can avoid worshipping a respectable man or a demigod and may be called discourteous, but one cannot avoid serving the Supreme Lord without being thoroughly condemned. Every living entity is part and parcel of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and thus every living entity is intended to serve the Supreme Lord by his constitution. Failing to do this, he falls down. The Bhagavatam confirms this as follows: Ya esham purusham shakshad atma prabhavam ishwaram dabajanti avajananti stanad brashta patantyadha. Anyone who does not render service and neglects his duty unto this primeval Lord, who is the source of all living entities, will certainly fall down from his constitutional position. And of all yogis, the one with great faith who always abides in me, thinks of me within himself, and renders transcendental loving service to me, he is most intimately united with me in yoga, and is the highest of all. This is my opinion. So this verse of the Srimad Bhagavad Gita brings to conclusion the first six chapters of the Gita. And specifically speaks of considering yoginam api sarvesam. Yoginam means of all yogis. So many yogis are there. Yoginam api sarvesam madgatena antaratmana. That yogi whose consciousness is completely within, antaratmana, and within themselves, is able to live in the experience of their soul, their atma, and also perceive the supreme soul, the paramatma, madgatin antaratmana, who's able to perceive me, mad, Krishna is saying, who's able to perceive me deeply within themselves. Shraddhavan bhajate yomam, and perceiving me deeply within themselves, then having the shraddha, or faith, shraddhavan bhajate, then begins service as an expression of love. Shraddhavan bhajate yomam, bhaj, Prabhupada mentions the root of bhaj. Also, Bhaktivinoda Thakur quotes the Gurudha Purana, bhajite shavai dhatu sevanam parikirtita, tasmat seva barai prokta bhakti sadhana bhuyasi. That the very dhatu, or of bhaj, is bhaj iti shavai dhatu sevanam parikirtita, is service. Service beginning with as a duty and progressively moving on to as an expression of love. Shraddhavan bhajate yomam temi yukta tamo mataha. Then in my view, Krishna is saying, of all those who have this characteristic, they are the topmost of yogis. Now, considering this view, but considering this presentation here of Krishna, the Supreme Lord, presenting that one who is a devout meditator on him is the topmost of all, not only meditating on him is the topmost of all yogis, but who has gone beyond meditation to the service spirit, Bhajate, who's engaged in service and worship and adoration, all those qualities related to that. They are the topmost of all. And we speak of yoga, this is what we speak of. Perhaps for us the ultimate purpose of yoga. But it may be peculiar that then why is yoga considered, you know, a $27 billion industry around the world? $27 billion. Yoga's made more money than Microsoft around the world. And is it based upon what's presented here in this verse? Well, perhaps not exactly. Maybe ultimately. So, why is it so? $27 billion people are spending on yoga. It's big business, very big business. Recently, just in December, I was in South Africa, and we took a flight from Johannesburg to Durban. Now, my daughter, she was 15 at the time. She's now 16. She's doing her Duke of Edinburgh Awards for the school, her school. So they're very busy with all these things, and she had to do one specific thing, you know, related to health and all the rest of it. So she chose to do yoga, and she started yoga classes with Padma Malini. So aside from the chaos of her life, she started doing these yoga classes, and I'd pick her up and drop her off, and we never discussed it too much. But when I was on a flight recently, we were flying from Johannesburg to Durban, and as we were going along in the flight, as we were coming closer to Durban, and the airplane started to, you know, experience turbulence, and it was moving around. You know that feeling when you're on an airplane, it starts to shake a bit. So I'm a terribly nervous flyer, ridiculously. The airplane started to shake around a little bit, and I turned to the lady beside me in the plane, and I said, you know, I really don't like it when these airplanes start to shake around in the sky. You know, I feel so absolutely vulnerable. And she turned back to me and said, don't worry, my son's a pilot, and I know that these planes, they can shake around so much, it's not a problem. Don't even think about it. But then it got really bad. It got so bad, there was lightning outside, it became completely dark, the plane was really going all over, and by this time the woman was sitting, you know, she was regretting her words to me, you know. She was starting to look desperate as well. And as the airplane went, it was going down lower and lower, and it was shaking around terribly. Everybody was silent. And then all of a sudden, the airplane turned, and the pilot put it into the full power. And it shot into the sky again, straight up, accelerated, everyone was sitting. And then it leveled out again, and there was a huge outburst of laughter in the airplane, which I thought was so peculiar. I thought when people are really, really nervous and terrified in a situation, everybody started laughing. So then as we were just flying along again, after some time, the pilot, he said, I'm very sorry, we just flew into a storm, and I was unable to land the airplane, but I'm going to just turn the plane around, and we're going to come in from a different direction and try to land again. And everybody was thinking, oh God, you know, oh my gosh, everybody was thinking. So as we started to come in again, the same scenario started to happen on the airplane. And everybody was terrified. And I was sitting, by that time, I was probably watching something on the in-flight entertainment, but by that time I had my beads on my hand. I was sitting doing my mantra of, you know, Hare Krishna, 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 Hare Hare. My wife was sitting in front of me. She was like, I need paracetamol. And next to me, my daughter was sitting. Behind her, there was a Christian lady. And that lady had her rosary beads. And we were looking at each other. I was chanting in my mala. She was chanting in her rosary beads. And I think the look of each other, that we were getting on with our meditation, our prayers, we were scaring each other even more about the situation. And at that moment, my daughter turned around to me and she said, Dad, she said, try some yoga breathing. So what? I was there praying away, you know, trying to meditate on a Krishna. My daughter said, "Dad, try some yoga breathing." Something obviously Padma Malini has been teaching her. And I thought, okay, let me just... So in that moment then, I just focused on my breath, as you do in yoga, calming everything down, creating a... meditating on myself as an eternal soul, and that no matter what happens, I will be unaffected ultimately. And with that then, the airplane came into land. The storm got worse, it flew up in the air again, and it had to go back to Johannesburg because it couldn't land. But in that situation, obviously, even my daughter seeing her father, who's been, you know, 30 years practicing mantra meditation and all of these things, just saw and had experienced a method that she felt could help me in my situation. She was quite at comfort with everything. I think maybe you're like that when you're 16, you know, it's like, it's another kind of, you know, Big Dipper ride or something. She recommended to me a method that would help me in pursuit of my meditation. And I think that what I wanted to focus on today was just that, yoga being a method, or the things that were all related to what ultimately became called yoga, as it was systematized through time by, you know, great philosophers and teachers of South Asia, most well-known perhaps Patanjali Muni, who really systematized it into 8 steps. So as a method which so many traditions of spirituality, so many movements of health, of peace, have all adopted elements of this method, of these methods that were systematized into what famously became known as yoga, applied it to their own traditions, and then claimed this is the purpose of yoga. But more, yoga being a methodology or a technology through which a person can create a space between them and their environment, and within that space, perhaps meditate on things or qualities or virtues which will assist that person to be their very best. Recently I was, even Anthony Robbins, he's like the coach of the world. He's been everybody in the world's coach, and you know, he's a motivational speaker. You know, he's done every country. He's been the coach of every famous person or whatever. They were talking to him on an interview and asking him, "What do you do? What do you do in the morning? You know, what do you do in the morning to get yourself so, you know, excited about the day?" And he said, "Well, I do a kind of meditation." Now, meditation is one part of ultimately what's all related to yoga. Perhaps we'll call it dharana or dhyan, when you've reached the stage of restraint of your senses or through whatever physicality or whatever, you've reached the point of calmness. At that point, you can really focus your mind or meditate. So dharana, dhyan, ultimately samadhi, is the ultimate state of it. So meditate. He was saying, "Oh, I do some meditation in the morning." He said, "What do you..." "Well, I call it priming, you know, priming, priming. I sit down, I breathe heavily, I get myself oxygenated." This is what pranayam, isn't it? This is the old breathing methodologies of getting yourself into a very clear consciousness, stillness. Pranayam, I do some breathing, I get myself... If you haven't seen Tony Robbins, this is a very poor impersonation of him, but he's much larger than that. And then he said, I meditate on gratitude. You know, I feel gratitude for every moment. So in his bringing stillness to himself through the breathing, then he's focusing on a virtue. He's meditating on a virtue, an incredible virtue that can change the entire quality of a person's life, gratitude. Every speaker nowadays, TED lecturer, whatever, who begins to make a presentation on happiness, you know, the principles of happiness in life, they all begin with gratitude. Gratitude's so solidly in there. Gratitude. So he meditates on the virtue of gratitude. He thinks of experiences he's had in his life, people he's met, or whatever, and he feels gratitude. And then from within himself, he sends out love and respect and all those things to all people. Then his focus, he focuses on now today and what I want to achieve today. You know, imagine myself in that state, I'll be there. It's all the modern coaches, they'll tell you. It begins when you get up in the morning, you're standing in front of the mirror, you tell yourself, I have a six-pack because I go to the gym every day, I work out. And you will have that six-pack. You'll have that muscular frame that you want to have by that deep focus and meditation on yourself as having successfully achieved. So, in every sense, even most contemporary speakers, they're all speaking pretty much about the same methodologies. You know, restraint, meditation, focus, virtue, value, and purpose. All drawing from principles of yoga. So just as my daughter was recommending to me on that flight, you know, try yoga breathing as a method to help you meditate on your Lord, on your God, on what's meaningful for you in your life. She's not into this as much as I'm into it, so. But immediately as a method, I was able to incorporate it. Immediately. It just made sense. I'll use it. Another situation of just recent. I was sitting waiting for someone, and I picked up the Men's Health magazine. You probably see it in the shops now, Men's Health. It always has somebody on the front, you know, with very good physique, you know, well-tuned, fine-looking man, you know, the real kind of stereotypical, successful, heroic-looking man. And so I thought, anyway, we'll pick it up. Something I'll pick it up and have a read at it. So generally you flick through it, you know, it's everything from, you know, how to boost your sexual attraction to other people, how to, you know, get on with all these things which may be core interests to men. And then all this thing, a diet, you know, all different types of diet, and then all different types of pills that you can take in order to, you know, speed up the whole process of you losing weight and getting that beach body that you want. And there are different stuff and exercises that, you know, great, successful physical people have done. You pick the magazine up, it's a whole caricature of men in the magazine and how you can become one. Rather than that kind of flabby 50-year-old thing that looks a bit more like, what do you call him, from the American TV series, cartoon, famous, Homer Simpson. Homer Simpson. I've been going to the gym recently. I walked and I just thought, God, more like Homer Simpson amongst these people. So, anyway, I picked up the magazine, I flicked through a few pages, and I came to this article, which was about the masculinity crisis. And what was very interesting about this very short article on the masculinity crisis, it undermined everything about the magazine that had published the article. Everything. It spoke about how this image of man, you know, having the physique of, well, probably not Arnold Schwarzenegger, but it's somewhere in between that and something else. You know, having that. And having the career, you know, your own business, your entrepreneur, all, having that career, having that attractiveness to women, and just really cutting the mustard in life and being a successful young man and all that entailed, had created something which they were calling the masculinity crisis. And the study of that, studying the great crisis in masculinity. And what they said was is that it was this man's need, and specifically men, in this case it was Men's Health, man's need to be awesome. To be awesome. And the failure to be awesome, it said like 81% of the misery, the trouble, and the distress that comes along with that venture to be awesome is self-imposed upon the man himself. It's programmed into our heads so much that the whole depressive element that comes along with that, I mean, let's face it, how many of us are really awesome in that? You stereotype the thing, this is awesome. You know, perhaps for a woman, it's the zero size. You know, God, what percentage of that is that of women? I don't know. So to be awesome, 80% of the nightmare and the hell that comes to a person from that is literally self-imposed from their own mind. So the guy was saying, you know, much as I hate to say, this working out at the gym, this professional dynamism, this, you know, stereotypical image of man that you're all achieving, that, you know, all the methods that you're achieving to get that, they're only increasing your misery more. Then he came to the solutions. He came to the solution. He said, after having studied all of this subject, which has been researched, I've come to this conclusion. That the number one thing that you can do to address and alleviate yourself from this is yoga. Yoga. Sri Sri Radha Gokulananda Ki. The number one thing that a person can do, in his view, the writer, to alleviate this masculinity crisis was yoga. And can you guess what was number two? Have a guess. What do you think, ladies? You probably know more about men than men do. Huh? That was kind of within the yoga, that. No, that was yoga kind of covered all that stuff for him. Sport, no.
Exercise.
No. 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 No, it was therapy. 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 Yoga and therapy. I mean, really. That's how messed up everything is. That's how messed it up. But why yoga? When they speak of yoga, immediately they speak of calmness. Just calm down, my friend. Just cool down. Isn't it? When you're in a situation, perhaps, you upset somebody and they're just like going off. And you think, oh, calm. This is like, calm down. You know, wait. Just breathe. And then they get, and that anger management, isn't it? Anger management, all these things, dispute resolution, the first thing they recommend, isn't it? Point number one, get out of the situation you're in immediately. Well, yoga is a method. Get out of your situation immediately from where you are. Because maybe the people, the environment, everything is determining, and that's been the whole cause of your breakdown. Remove yourself from that environment. And so therefore, yoga, again, this space, the creation of this space between those things which are influencing us, and our mood, and our thoughts, and ourself. The space between. Yoga is a method. A method that assists to create that space between us and all those things that are making us be what we are not really, what we don't really want to be. Perhaps another and a very dramatic example of this is given. Stephen Covey, cites this example in the beginning of his book, The Seven Habits of Highly Effective People. You've probably all read that book at some point in your life. It's probably now, it was very popular in the 1990s, was it, I think? Very popular. Even we were having courses in it. And in the beginning of the book, he's trying to create this space or to provoke a person's thinking towards this space. Because, and it's all related to business life. It's part of the business management leadership library. This whole thing, you know, you're going to be a leader. You have to be able to get in that space. Isn't it? You got to get there. If you're just, if everything that's, you're responding to everything in your environment and every situation, you won't be able to lead people. You'll just be responding to your environment. So with regards to that, he raises the subject of stimuli and response. Yeah? So there's all the things that happen that stimulate us in various ways, isn't it? Like, for instance, if I got off this seat and walked out the door and somebody Puneet turned to me and said, that was a terrible class. Yeah, I'd be like, thanks. You know, obviously, isn't it? If you walk into the Prashad Hall and the person serving Prashad sees you and says, serve yourself. Or, you know, I don't want to serve you. You're that troubling, miserable person. You think, what? If you walk by, a couple of people are talking in the corridor and you walk by and you're walking along and they say something like, Saurabh, he's an idiot, that fella. And you hear, what? Immediately. If someone insults someone close to you, you can be driven to kill someone. You can feel those feelings within yourself. Immediately. Without a thought. Obviously, anger management's the program of, you know, people who get excessive in small things. You know, they go from naught to whatever in moments over stuff like, you know, maybe you never cleaned up on your cleaning day or something like that. You go to troubling levels. Anyway, Kobi was speaking about this, and he gave the example of Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl is a Jewish psychoanalyst in the line of Freud, who had survived the Nazi war camps of Germany. The Nazi war camps around the world, the Holocaust. And in those concentration camps, you know, he was, his family were killed. You know, life, unimaginable circumstances. And his job was like piling bodies into chambers, stacking bodies up, shoveling the ashes. It was just such a complete degradation of life. And then an experience where he was naked, surrounded by his persecutors. And in that moment, he experienced what he called the last human freedom. The last human freedom. And he realized that there was a space between him and his persecutors. There was a space between him and his environment. And in that space, and regardless of how they tried to make him suffer, how they tried to hurt him, within that space, he could determine completely what he wanted to feel, how he wanted to behave, and that he wouldn't suffer. So, though the stimuli is coming continuously into our senses, he realized the space between that sensual experience and our choice as individuals. So rather than being a kind of environmental determinism, that's the everything in our environment is determining how we're going to behave today, that it's more self-determinism. That I will live, I will behave, I will progress in a way determined by myself and not by my environment. Again, if that's not what would you say the experience or that the method of yoga creates, then what is it? So generally, now I'm feeling like the BBC's gone. I'm just talking all these material things continuously with regards to yoga. Yoga is a method. Yoga with regards to creating that space between us and life. Now, even as you saw in the example when my daughter was speaking to me, even in bhakti, it's important. Now, just perhaps very briefly to just wind up and relate this topic of methods of yoga creating a space through which we can determine what we want to do ourselves. Largely, I mean, when we speak of yoga, from the bhakti perspective, it has a completely different set of ramifications than when people speak about it generally. And generally, people speak of yoga. It's you know, there's this one thing in critical theory, that a word is just a signifier. Does a word have intrinsic meaning? Or is it just a sound that signifies whatever we want that sound to signify? And if we have a shared understanding of what that word means to us, then, you know, it's useful to us. We can talk to each other. We can communicate. The one famous, you know, German philosopher, Friedrich Nietzsche, he was incredible. He mentioned that anything that has a history, you cannot subject it to definition. Because anything that has a history is continuously changing. It's in the process of change, continuously. What a word meant centuries ago, what the same word means today, may be completely different things. It's a signifier. So yoga is a signifier. When we say the word yoga, if we're sitting with around a table with 10 people, we'll probably get 10 different responses to what yoga signifies for them. Everything from the National Health Service has given their definition of yoga. Traditional program of exercise which can improve your health and well-being. You know, so if you speak to people who do Hatha yoga, the yoga of force. You speak to people who do Raj yoga, that's Patanjali's yoga. You speak to people who do Vikram yoga, hot yoga. There's people who do hair yoga. You know, 6 yoga exercises for hair loss. At one point, I remember when a recent yogi from India was traveling, you'd be sitting, talking to people, and they'll be sitting like this. Have you seen this exercise? You've seen that? Where did you see that one? You probably saw maybe some of the ladies of the family doing it. Some of the balding men doing it. They're sitting like that, doing that. Why? Because it stimulates the hair growth. Something like that. So people are just sitting, spending the time. Something like that. Stimulating the hair growth. Not something Hare Krishnas are too worried about. They're always managing the problems of hair. So, you know, even with regards to laughing yoga, everything, you know, there's just so many different things. Perhaps if we were to look at the generality, perhaps the big generalities of with regards the way the word is being used, you know, restraint, yoke, isn't it? We often say that, yoke. You harness. What do you yoke up the horses for? To let them go free? To bring them into control? So the earliest references to yogic practices in the Upanishads, they speak about, that's how they introduce the subject. There's one young person who's challenged by the Yamaraj, the god of death. And he asks, you know, for many things, but then he finally asks, you know, how can I overcome death? He says, oh, that's a huge subject. So, ultimately the response comes, well, your body's like a chariot, your senses are like the horses, and you got to yoke them up. You know, we yoke up the oxen here. They're incredibly powerful animals. They're more powerful than us. Far more powerful. I mean, people go over to feed a nice cow, they go like that to feed the cow, and the cow goes, what? Isn't it going to knock you out? I remember years ago going over to one of our cows in the field, you know, and you're in that romantic cow protect, you know, Krishna the cow, her boy, a beautiful cow, and over to one of our big cows to just stroke it and turn its head. Boom! And it went, almost knocked me out. Yeah, I stood back a bit like that, you know. So, these animals, that's why, Singinam, Chanakya recommends, you know, rivers and all these things don't have faith in animals with horns. All our animals have horns. Never put trust in an animal with horns. They don't mean anything. You turn their head. So, these incredibly powerful beasts, how do we utilize them in such a way? That sounds terrible. But how do we engage them in such a way in order to further our necessities within life? Or to complement it. We'll care for them, but they work for us. Let's face it. Of course, Rasa probably feels he works for all of them every day. Serves the cows and bulls, but bringing that huge thing under control and then engaging it for beneficial purposes to life. This is yoga. This is how the yoga is introduced in the early Upanishads. This restraint of the senses and utilizing them for beneficial purpose. Now, so one side, yoga is the yoking or the joining or the connecting or the restraint which gives you the space. On the other side, it's towards the connection with divinity or in our case Krishna. It's that connecting, it's that yoking, it's that journey. And therefore in every chapter of the Gita, yoga, isn't it? Arjun Vishad Yog, Sankhya Yog, Karma Yog, Gyan Yog, Sannyas Yog, Dhyan Yog, Vigyan Yog, and on and on and on and on. Everything's yog, because every element, whether it's work, whether it's knowledge, whether it's devotion, everything has that central point of connection of these two principles, restraint and dedication. Restraint, dedication, focus, absorption. So, certainly, for us, we're speaking of all the same things generically, but our process is phenomenally enhanced. Because in that, like in this verse, and I'll just wrap up on this here. In this verse, Yoginamapi Sarvesham Madgatena Antaratmana Shradavan Bhajate Yomam. You know, this brings this whole process to another level. And what brings it to another level is this one thing, Shraddhavan. Either through perception, experience, from hearing or from learning, that this Shraddha or faith, yoga rather than being a process of discovery, for us, because we have faith, Shraddhavan Bhajate Yomam, faith in Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, faith in his instructions, then we engage in the yoga of complete dedication of ourselves, devotion, bhakti yoga, and follow a process that ultimately that should flourish and become pure love. So yoga has its place in terms of its methodology. It's just that as everybody, that point of ultimate meditation or focus or remembrance of Krishna, isn't it? Rupa Goswami sums up the whole sadhana bhakti is just the whole matter of this is somehow or other fix your mind on Krishna. Always remember, never forget Krishna. That's the ultimate. Every kirtan, every class, every dance, every book that's distributed, every sabji that's cooked, every puja that's performed, and all of these activities of sadhana, he says that yena kena upayena mana Krishna niveshayat. That somehow or other, mind fixed on Krishna. Completely. Focus. Dhyan, that's samadhi. That's samadhi in the devotional theology. So from kirtan, everyone's dancing there, and probably the BBC are thinking, you know, what's the yoga? This looks nothing like yoga. This is so far from yoga. But if you look at it in substance, it's so close, but it's going on so far and beyond yoga. Sometimes I say, yoga is... bring your body into fine tuning, meditation for your mind. But the heart is the missing reconciliation of heart. People have this, they want to love, they want to be loved. It's just, we have this, it's an undeniable element of ourself. So until it comes to the point of devotion or comes to the point of bhakti, then the complete well-being of a person will never be achieved. And therefore, the best of all yogis is the yogi who comes to embrace that principle. Thank you very much for your attention.